You are all extremely welcome to this debate on the International Criminal Court, the title to which I presume is behind me, and it has the grabby, provocative phrases, universal justice or bullying the South. And it's, of course, also an opportunity for me to mention that there is this superb book, Global Civil Society, the authoress of which I think has just entered. No, not quite, not yet. She will shortly. And you can purchase this outside at the end of this lecture. And the authors and the centre are so generous, they are offering you the chance to take home last year's as well. Free, a remarkable offer. Now, the only thing that's disappointing is that the offer doesn't take effect immediately. We have to go through this debate in order subsequently to have the chance to avail of this offer. I know it's why most of you are here. There you are. I've done my job. It gives me tremendous pleasure to introduce people whose work I know and whom I haven't, two of them met on this evening. Together with Marlies, who will introduce the subject. But we do want to have this as a discussion, as well as a debate between persons on the table here beside me. So I'm asking each of the speakers to speak for up to 15 minutes, possibly even between 10 and 15. And then we're going to have a discussion. And in the discussion, of course, there'll be opportunities for the speakers to develop some of their points. And we are going to end around, well, certainly before 8 o'clock, at probably between 10:02 and 5:02. The first speaker in our debate is Christopher Hall. Christopher is the legal advisor of Amnesty International. He's the co-founder of the NGO Coalition for an International Criminal Court, and he's published widely on the International Criminal Court. So I would like to ask Christopher to commence this evening's discussion.
Thank you. I'm only one of a number of legal advisors for Amnesty International. I'm certainly not the legal advisor, but thank you. And although I was involved in the process of setting up the coalition, I'd never thought of such an exalted title, but I really think I will, in light of the directive, I will try and keep my remarks short and to the point, and then some of the points could possibly be developed in the question time if people are interested. With regard to the first part of the title of tonight's panel, Universal Justice. The International Criminal Court, which was established almost 8 months ago, cannot now provide universal justice, nor is it likely to do so in the near future. As Sir Franklin Berman warned on another occasion, one must be a bit more realistic about its limitations. That said, however, one must not underestimate the revolutionary impact that the court is beginning to have on national as well as international law, on how countries, including non-states parties, wage war, and on public conceptions of justice, points which I hope to return to in a moment. One sign of its universality might be the number of signatures and ratifications that the Rome Statute has achieved so far. It's been signed by 139 states, a very high percentage of the approximately 190 states in the world, although two states, United States and Israel, have since repudiated their signatures. Almost half of all states, 89 of them as of about a week ago, have ratified the Rome Statute so far. And our research indicates that we should have well over 100 ratifications fairly soon, and that probably most of the states that have signed the statute, as well as some others, are likely to ratify the statute in the next few years. Nevertheless, it is extremely disappointing, if not entirely surprising, the number of large states have yet to ratify the Rome Statute, including not only the United States, but also China, India, Indonesia, Japan, Mexico, Pakistan, and the Russian Federation, all but two of which are usually considered to be in the South. Nevertheless, we're fairly optimistic that some of these states will soon ratify the statute, including Mexico, Japan, and probably within a decade, China. And depending on what happens in Chechnya, and the Russian Federation. Why are the numbers of ratifications important? Well, the jurisdiction of the court is limited, with one exception, to crimes committed by on the territory of a state party or by a state that made a declaration under Article 12, Paragraph 3 of the statute, recognizing the court's jurisdiction, and to crimes committed by nationals of those states. Therefore, of course, the court cannot at this point, just on the basis of ratifications, provide universal justice. However, in one respect, the court can be seen as being able to act universally already. And that is because the Security Council can refer the situation being considered under Chapter 7 to the court, even if that situation involves a state which has not ratified the statute. And then, of course, it will be up to the prosecutor to decide whether to seek to investigate the case, and then it will be up to the court to decide whether that request should be granted. However, even if the Rome Statute were to be ratified by all states, it would not be able to administer universal justice, nor should it. First, under the principle of complementarity, which is fundamental to the entire concept of the statute, the court is only able to exercise jurisdiction when states are unable or unwilling to do so. Second, it will never have the resources to exercise jurisdiction in all cases where states are unable or unwilling to act. Nevertheless, widespread ratification can indirectly secure universal justice by ensuring that the court can perform its primary role in the emerging system of international justice as a catalyst for investigations and prosecutions by national prosecutors and investigating judges. And in this connection, one largely overlooked aspect of the adoption of the Rome Statute has been its radical transformation of national criminal law and procedure in states' parties as they enact implementing legislation. The second part of tonight's panel's title, Bullying the South, echoes the great myth about universal jurisdiction that was perpetuated when the former president of Chile was arrested in London in October 1998, the same year that the Rome Statute was adopted. It was asserted that this request was simply an example of the North oppressing the South, and in particular, a former colonial power continuing to oppress one of its former colonies, ignoring requests by Switzerland, France, and Belgium to arrest them for murder and torture of their own citizens. And perhaps it reflects a sort of conception really of accountability of one state to another based on state responsibility rather than concepts of individual responsibility. Indeed, nothing could have been further from the truth than this assertion. The arrest of the former president, like the adoption of the Rome Statute a few months earlier, is part of a sea change in international law. Since 1998, crimes under international law are no longer seen as diplomatic and political events involving states to be resolved by diplomats and politicians. Instead, they are understood to be ordinary crimes by individuals involving murder, kidnapping, assault, and rape, to be investigated and prosecuted by prosecutors and investigating judges at the national as well as the international level. At the same time, these horrible acts are recognized in the preamble to the Rome Statute as crimes of concern to the entire international community which is the duty of each state to repress. However, it may still be argued that there are imbalances in international justice between the North and the South that are reflected in the court. Well, let me give you one example, and that is that the center of criminality, when we're talking about crimes under international law, has largely shifted to the South. And indeed, this is perhaps one of the key factors that led states in the South, as well as non-governmental organizations in the South, to press for the adoption of the Rome Statute. And indeed, they played a key role in all stages of the past decade in the establishment of the court. In fact, I see in the back of the room one of the key drafters of the Rome Statute, Fabrizio Guerilla, who was on the Argentine delegation, and you're lucky to have as a teacher here. Approximately half of the states that have signed the Rome Statute are from outside Europe and North America, and about 45 states out of the 89 that have ratified it are from the South. 8 of the 18 judges are from the South. And it is more probable than not that the prosecutor will be selected from a country in the Southern Hemisphere. Finally, most of the complaints that are being brought to the court are from victims or their families in the South, against persons associated with governments or armed political groups in the South. But they also, in some cases, highlight the role of individuals from northern countries that are accomplices in such crimes, whether as trainers, suppliers of arms, or as combatants or mercenaries. Indeed, the first state complaint is likely to come from a state in the South about a situation in the eastern part of its country, that is the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Of course, it is not beyond the realm of possibility that the Security Council could refer a situation to the court in the next few years, but it could only do so realistically with the concurrence of countries in the South. However, I'm firmly convinced that the court is unlikely to become a tool of the Security Council against the South, as was feared by many countries at Rome.
Thank you, Christopher, very much, not least for staying precisely within the time, exactly halfway between 10 and 15 minutes. And I apologize for suggesting that you were the only legal advisor, but on the advice of a much exercised Marlies, I stand by the allegation that you're the co-founder. Our next speaker is known to us all here, and it's terrific to have her speaking on a subject on which she is fast developing an international reputation, and that's Marlies Glasius beside me, the research officer at the Center. Her research at the Center for the Study of Global Governance is the theory and practice of global civil society, and in particular, its relationship to international law. Mary wasn't present when I waved the book about, so I now say she's written the chapter on the ICC and global civil society 2002, waving the book about for the second time, Mary, and is writing a book on the International Criminal Court, a global civil society achievement, which suggests that we're about to hear some upbeat remarks, but I should be most interested. Marlies.
Actually, no. I'm not sure about the allegation that I'm developing an international reputation either, but I won't challenge it. As I just looked over my speech, I realised that I'd kind of taken too much of a matter of course the positive aspects of the court and been a bit too negative, so I'll start with something very upbeat. When I started reading on the International Court, I found out that it was kind of customary if you wrote an article on the International Criminal Court, and I found that, for instance, Chris Fold did this, but many other authors as well, that you kind of open it with a grand statement of the promise of the court and what it might do. My grand statement in this chapter was as follows, that it was a small revolution in international law and the conduct of international relations. Also, it was an important step in the ongoing transition towards an international legal order that is less based on state sovereignty and more oriented towards the protection of all citizens of the world from abuse of power. Now, more or less, I still stand by that, apart from the ongoing transition. I'm no longer so sure that it's an ongoing transition. I think it's very reversible. So by and large, I am a fan. I'm not going to say that much about the universal justice aspect. I think I very much agree with what Chris said. It's not a panacea against human rights violations. It has many limitations, but it can deliver some global justice some of the time. And I think more importantly, it can be and will be a symbol representing the idea that no one is above the law, which is not something the Yugoslavia Tribunal or the Rwanda Tribunal could deliver because they were so very specific. I think it is also an example of how the building or the restructuring of global governance institutions might be done. In this time that we think so much about the United Nations and the NATO, and whether they still work, whether they should be different, whether other institutions like perhaps the World Parliament are necessary. I think this is a very interesting example of a very recently built global institution. And I just wanted to make two points about this. One was already made by Christopher Hall. The very strong participation of civil society groups. I think, and I describe in my chapter, that it pushed the court in directions that it would otherwise not have gone, and you can't conclusively prove that, but I try to adduce a lot of evidence towards that idea. In two areas in particular, the independent prosecutor, in the original draft that went to negotiation by states, the idea was that only either the Security Council all individual states could bring a case to the court, could trigger an investigation, as it was called. And I think it was especially very hard pushing from NGOs, human rights organizations, lawyers organizations, peace organizations, and so on, which brought this idea that you would have to have a prosecutor capable of independently deciding to investigate in order to have a meaningful court. That was a very strong contribution. Also, the idea that there should be a gender aspect to international criminal law, that so-called gender-neutral international criminal law actually disadvantages women. So there's now a very strong, very specific language in different parts of the statute for an international criminal court, both on gender crimes, on gender representation, in the judges in the prosecutorial office, on gender-specific expertise, on protection, and so on and so forth. So my first point was very strong global civil society participation, very interesting. The second point is that the International Criminal Court was negotiated in a way, in a traditional way, namely in the United Nations circles, whereas another important treaty, also with very much civil society participation, which was negotiated almost at the same time, the Landmines Ban Convention, was taken away from the United Nations to what was called a coalition of the willing. Only those states who wanted such a convention participated in the negotiations. In the ICC negotiations, there was participation from the very unwilling, China, India, Israel, Iraq, and at that time, still more or less willing, the United States. And there was a tremendous effort at the time that was put into keeping the United States on board, and in fact, Sir Franklin Berman knows all about that because he made a tremendous effort. And as a result, we now have a jurisdiction regime that was described by Chris Hall that is neither quite progressive enough to satisfy the NGOs in some states like Germany, nor quite restrictive enough for the United States, who would only want it to be possible to persecute people on the basis of nationality. Now, the United States is pretty much an implacable enemy of the court. I'll go into that a little bit more. Now, it's very easy for me, of course, to speak with hindsight, but it's an open question to both people who have been involved in the negotiations, whether with hindsight, the coalition of the willing leading to a court that went further might have been an option. Then I come to the other half of the title, the bullying in the South. I'm going to outline three ways in which you could interpret that bullying of the South. The one, I think, is false, but there is some truth in it. The other is really happening, but so far not terribly successful. And the third is the real challenge. The first is the idea that the negotiations that led to the institution of the court were itself a bullying of the South, or to use another term, legal imperialism. A small group of Western states called the like-minded group, Canada, the Scandinavian countries, the United Kingdom, kind of more or less hijacked in this reading 120 states into voting for a treaty that was more forceful and more intrusive than they had intended. And they were helped in this conspiracy by the non-governmental organizations. And I caricature a little bit, but this is a view that you often hear from people who oppose the International Criminal Court. The idea is that many southern countries who were involved in these negotiations had only few relatively uninformed and overworked diplomats at the negotiations, and they just could not follow the negotiations all by themselves. The NGOs, by giving them help, and they did give a lot of help in the form of interns provided, expertise provided, pushed them in a certain direction. Now, as I said, I think it's a caricature. First of all, the NGOs were not Northern. If you have a look at all the NGOs represented, it was really a very global representation. One area that was underrepresented was the Middle East and North Africa, and I think that's for a very obvious reasons, because there is not much space for civil society there. Otherwise, it was really a global representation. Secondly, I do not think, however much help you give states, it will not go against their own interests. They're just not going to vote for, then sign, then ratify a treaty that they do not want. So I don't think there was bullying. I do think that there was a lot of badgering, not just of the South, but of all state representatives by NGOs to push in a certain direction. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. As I said, I think there is a slight bit of merit in his argument. There is a slight problem that I would outline with an example. There was someone representing at the negotiations the Solomon Islands, who is actually a British lawyer and a very distinguished one, Andrew Clapham, and he did an excellent job. One of the proposals he made that didn't make it, but it was a very interesting proposal, was that corporations should also, in principle, be punishable, triable before the court. And it was a proposal that didn't make it. Now, on the merit, I think that was an interesting and a good proposal, but I do wonder what the people of the Solomon Islands would have thought of it, because he was representing them, and I do really wonder about that sort of representation when you bring something in that really has nothing to do with the interests of the particular state you're supposed to be representing. So I do think there's a slight issue there, also for future negotiations with strong civil society participation, which I'm in favour of in principle. The second bullying of the South I would refer to is the present United States policy towards the International Criminal Court. I don't know to what extent you've all been following it, but the United States is pushing very hard, not just the South in terms of really kind of developing countries, but also many countries in Central and Eastern Europe, to make agreements that they refer to as Article 98 agreements, which will make the United States, especially military staff, immune to the court. These negotiations are secret. It's very difficult to follow exactly what's going on. It's clear that the connection is being made with military aid being given to these countries, sometimes also with NATO membership, sometimes also with other forms of aid. As of 29 January, courtesy of Amnesty International, I found this out, 18 states had actually signed such treaties. And I'll read them out because I think it will give you an interesting idea of who they are. Afghanistan, Djibouti, Dominican Republic, East Timor, El Salvador, Gambia, Honduras, India, Israel, the Marshall Islands, Mauritania, Micronesia, Nepal, Palau, Romania, Sri Lanka, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. Now, I don't think this is that worrying or impressive a list. India is a very big country, obviously, but it was always an enemy of the court, so it's not a surprise. The same is true for Israel. Countries like Palau, Micronesia and the Marshall Islands, of course it's a pity, but I don't think they're that substantial. I think the real problem is that apparently countries like East Timor, Sri Lanka, Honduras, Romania can be found. And I don't know whether it was bullying or whether they were willing to accede that wasn't there in the negotiations. But I think it's a problem that these countries are willing to say any US military personnel that comes into our territory will be immune. The bigger problem, of course, also of peacekeeping operations, and that's going to come up again next summer. So I do think there is that present US policy can be considered bullying the South, even also bullying the European Union, but perhaps with less success. Then the third kind of strand of bullying the South, this is the thing for the future, and it actually bothers me the most. It relates to what Chris Hall said about the centre of criminality being in the South. I do think that's correct. But I think the Yugoslavia Tribunal is an example of what should not happen. It was funded and staffed by the North, above all by the United States. The judges, of course, were from everywhere, but the prosecutor's office was very much dominated by the West, and in particular by the United States. Linked to that, and I think it is linked to that, whether or not you can establish a link, it's linked to that in the minds of people. There was no serious investigation of this bombing of the television tower in Kosovo. Now, whether or not that was a war crime, whether or not Carla Del Ponte was correct in her assessment that it was not worth investigating, I think the fact that it didn't get a serious investigation at the very least made that court lose a lot of legitimacy, because everyone looked at the prosecutorial office and said, these are Americans, therefore it's not being looked at. Now, we don't need to worry about the International Criminal Court being American-dominated. I think that is obvious. But we could have, once again, a Norden-funded, Norden-staffed court prosecuting only Southern suspects, and it will just not look good for universal justice. The funding is scaled over the states that have ratified, but over and above that are voluntary contributions, both from states and from whoever wants to donate. If you want to donate $1 million to the International Criminal Court, you can do so. And one private entity that's done so is the MacArthur Foundation. And the staffing, in principle, is open, but in practice, because of the necessity for a lot of expertise and having to be willing to go and live in The Hague, and possible behind the scenes, you know, pushing from funders, it may still be rather Norden. Now, I would not know what to advise, what kind of advice you can give a prosecutor what to do about this, except that in principle, everyone who commits these crimes should be subject to trial, so that in that sense, there is not bullying, because it's a danger to legitimacy. So I would say, if nationals of northern states commit these crimes, and I do think it happens less often, but it's not unthinkable, and if their own courts are unwilling to prosecute, and again, not unthinkable, they should also be subject to the International Criminal Court. But that will be an incredible challenge for the International Criminal Court, because then it might actually find not just the United States, but also the European states, or for instance, Canada or Australia against it. I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marlies. Final speaker in this, the more formal part of the evening, is Sir Franklin Berman, and legal advisor to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for a number of years during the 1990s, now a visiting professor of international law at Oxford, Cape Town, and King's College London. And he was the head of the United Kingdom delegation to the Rome Conference on the Statute for an International Criminal Court. So we're, I'm sure, all of us most interested to hear what you have to say today.
Thank you very much. I shall be short, because like the rest of you, I'm looking forward most keenly to discussion in a round table and to finding out, after a gap of a few years, exactly what interested and concerned citizens of the world think about this court and its prospects and dangers. The International Criminal Court is a much misunderstood subject. So thank you for the opportunity to contribute further to the misunderstanding. One can start, if you like, with the... I'll make one small contribution to understanding. Anybody coming to the terminology of the subject will be bothered by the reference to the Rome Statute, as if there were a whole series of statutes of the International Criminal Court from which you could choose one. The fact that a particularly enthusiastic participant in this negotiation managed to attach the name of its capital city as an adjective qualifying the statute shouldn't confuse one with the fact that this is the international statute for this international body. There is a problem with the ICC, a problem of unreasonable expectation, problem of balancing expectation and reality. I'll come back to that at the end if I remember. But like Christopher Hall, I was also a bit bothered by the title inflammatory as it is, the title for this evening's roundtable. I was bothered by both sides of it, both the bullying on the South side and the universal justice. I'm not sure that I know what I mean by universal justice, although there is an idea there which one can capture. I can certainly tell you that one of the principal elements of the instructions I took from government here in London before going to the conference, and I may add to that that I think that the British government did a meticulously thorough job of preparing for the conference and having discussed at the high governmental level the key issues that went into the composition of this court. One of the principal elements in our instructions was to go for universality on the assumption that the political and international purposes for which this institution was being created really demanded the widest possible degree of universality, the widest possible adherence to the court and to its process. And that, of course, means, you can't have it otherwise, that universality entails making compromises towards the interests of various states and various groups and groupings. You can't have it otherwise. I would be misleading you if I said that the only point in our instructions was universality. Absolutely not. There were certain minimum requirements which I think we happily exceeded in trying to draw the balance. And it was a triumph in a way that at the end of these extraordinarily difficult negotiations, there was overwhelming support for the statute when it was put up for adoption. On the other hand, it was not a triumph that what had been conducted up to that point as a consensus negotiation had to be put to a difficult and contentious vote. And it was not a triumph that there were some states who voted against it. So one has, as always, the rather bittersweet feeling with international negotiations of both achievement and failure. Now, that particular universality struggle isn't over. I'm not sure that I would agree that the United States is condemned to be an implacable opponent of the International Criminal Court. We'll see over time. One of the things we shall have to see, as Christopher Hall has reminded you, is how the relationship between the Security Council and the Court develops. It's got off to a pretty rocky start with resolution 1422, but that's only the beginning of a longer story. We shall see. As for the bullying the South bit, I wasn't quite sure either in my mind how to approach that. And I thought perhaps it was intended as a coded suggestion, coded question, is this court going to be subject to the criticism that was thrown at the Nuremberg and Tokyo press in the years afterwards. A lot of the criticism, one has to say, put forward in bad faith by those whose interest was not the successful prosecution of the sort of justice that those tribunals were set up to establish. But nevertheless, the criticisms of Nuremberg and Tokyo have resonated over the years, and one needs to look to see whether this tribunal will be open to the same sort of complaint. Nuremberg, they said, and Tokyo, those were victors, justice. That's the one thing we certainly don't have. I'm not sure that I object to victors, justice, because it seems to me that at the end of wars, particularly a war which at the final phase was fought in the name of the United Nations, in other words, the nations, the grouping of states which formed our world organization afterwards. But still, there's no room for the victors, justice allegation, because victor's justice lies only in a case where there has been a conflict and there is a victor after the event, which establishes a mechanism for meeting out justice. That we have avoided, and that was the whole point of creating a universal institution in advance. What else did they complain about in the case of Nuremberg? Well, it was a sort of retrospective victor's justice, because the crimes over which Nuremberg and Tokyo had jurisdiction were not clearly established and understood. Again, there's something in that criticism, to the extent to which some of the crimes under the Nuremberg Charter were not defined. They were left to a process of definition by the court itself, a thoroughly bad idea. A court ought to be given its jurisdiction, not asked to develop it from outside. But that's not an accusation that you can level against this particular court for any number of reasons, especially because the definitions aren't there in France. The substantive material jurisdiction of the court is defined. Secondly, because it was a really cardinal element in the minds of the essays that we had to meet that vital principle of the rule of law that offences must be defined in enough detail to justify the exercise of severe criminal jurisdiction of individuals. Well, there I think we acquitted ourselves pretty nobly. The definitions in the statute are extensive, more extensive and more comprehensive than any other definition of these crimes in any other instance. And if you want the final cherry on the top, the court is expressly instructed in a little known provision that it must not use its judicial powers to be creative or of new offences or to extend the terms of the offences beyond what has been done in the statute. So all of those things, I think, this court is pretty well proof against. There are other criticisms one could voice against Nuremberg, which I think are much more telling than the usual ones. One of them was procedure, and if it was doubtful in the case of Nuremberg, by golly, it was doubtful in the case of Tekio. The sort of procedure that was followed by those courts looks in retrospect like a procedure designed to ensure convictions and of making a demonstration to the world of the heavy majesty of the law being put to bear on selected miscreants. It wouldn't stand up to examination today, but there again I think that's a criticism of which this statute is free. It was informed by what is now well-recognized international jurisprudence arising out of the operation of the various regional human rights systems of the international human rights system of what the requirements for a fair trial are. And they are all adequately reflected, more than adequately reflected. I think one can say that the statute meets the highest attainable standards in that respect. Another criticism, which is not often voiced in Nuremberg and Tekio, but which is a valid one, is that the court and the prosecutorial power were composed of the victor states. Not quite so bad in Tokyo, where there were one or two judges from other states. Very striking in the case of Nuremberg, where the court was entirely composed of four victor states. And what's more, the prosecution in Nuremberg was divided up into four sections, one section coming from each of the four victor states, which leaves a most extraordinary taste in the mouth nowadays when the court looks back. And there again, the institutional approach towards this organization frees one automatically, cuts free any possible connection with the kind of serious doubt one might have about that process in the circumstances of the end of the Second World War. So, where are we left? Christopher Hall has already given you, fortunately, because one of the things that's fallen victim to my rushing here tonight is my list of the nominations and the elections to the bench of the International Criminal Court. If you do look, however, at the papers which are readily available on the UN website, and you see the pattern of nominations for the court came pretty widely from all areas of the world, with the exception perhaps of Latin America. The pattern of elections to the court does not suggest that the state's parties, who went through an endless series of rounds, that is, 33 rounds, didn't suggest that there was voting by the North en bloc of judges from the North in order to get a court that was composed entirely of the North. On the contrary, there are very interesting and welcome signs that judicial capacity and the need to be representative of the entire world was one of the factors that did, thank goodness, enter into that election. So there are all sorts of encouraging signs. And I go back to one element which I think was mentioned in previous discussions too, and that is the way the negotiation took place. Bullying there was, and I speak consciously, factors I have to my left, the alleged co-founder of the NGO Coalition for an International Criminal Court. There was lots of bullying, but I don't think the bullying was directed at anyone along one azimuth at all. There was plenty of bullying of states from all regions of the world. The bullying was part of the process. It was a very, very open, highly inclusive process. In some respects, crazy, in some respects, extraordinary. But if there was bullying, I don't think it was bullying in one direction. And I have a feeling in my bones, as another cynical diplomat, if you look at the voting at the end, there was a seesaw relationship between the discomfort felt by the United States of America at the end of the process and the way in which some of the countries of the Third World reacted to the final package. So I don't think one needs to worry about all of that. Where do we go from here? Very difficult to say. I think there is a problem of overstated expectations for the court. I've said again and again and again that I hope that the success of this court will not be judged by the number of prosecutions it deals with and the number of convictions it brings in. And I certainly hope that it will not be judged by the geographical spread of prosecutions and convictions. It's not the way the process is going to work. But I do come back to the fact that the political drive, the political justification behind creating this body was deterrence, 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 deterrence. Deterrence at the international level, the deterrence which was intended to work on the minds of those who might be tempted into committing abuses in the future, and deterrence of a different kind, which Christopher Hall has referred to, that there should be pressure exerted by the existence of this institution on national legal systems to do, to meet the responsibilities that international law has always regarded as falling from the national system. Does that leave us with an international criminal court, which is simply, as one of the speakers said, a symbol? I hope not. It's a profoundly unattractive recipe, isn't it? Can you imagine going to a distinguished judicial figure and saying we'd like you to accept the opportunity of being elected to a symbol? This has got to be a working institution. So there will have to be a proper diet of work for it to do, and will have to establish itself in the world broadly as a judicial body which meets the respect of its peers, the highest courts across the entire international constituency. I think there's a pretty good chance it's going to do so, but one of the ways in which we'll be encouraged to do so is by sympathetic and intelligent encouragement from outside, not instantaneous reactions of success or failure in what would be a very long drawn out enterprise.
Thank you very much, Sir Franklin. There's already three hands up, which shows four and rising. And I'm keeping my eyes on my text. Can we please emulate the discipline of the speakers who have each of them come in under 15 minutes? You're not allowed 15 minutes. But please firstly say who you are and whether you're from an organisation, if so, which one. Secondly, if you're making an observation that is inspired by a particular speaker or have a question to a particular speaker, please say so. And thirdly, please keep the comments reasonably short so that we can bring our speakers back in and make the round table work. We have about 35 minutes. I saw a lady in the front row, and I saw a gentleman with just this gentleman, so I'll take these first two. I'll take two or three first. It's a roving mic, I think. Madam.
Hi, my name is Geertje Buijs. I'm a solicitor in the City of London. I do work with public sector. And my question is specifically for Marlies Glasius. You said that only prosecuting defendants from the South would look bad. And you also mentioned how the situation where Carlo Del Ponte decided not to investigate in depth the bombing of the TV station in former Yugoslavia caused the Yugoslavia tribunal to lose credibility. Now, I've read recently that the campaign for nuclear disarmament is intending to request an investigation in the court in case the actions of the UK government, so to get Blair and Jack Straw investigated, if the actions in Iraq are going to be indiscriminate or contrary to international law. Now, I wondered if these investigations are going to be dismissed summarily, what would the effect on the credibility of the International Criminal Court be?
Thank you very much. I'm going to take one or two further questions. This gentleman I've got next, and this gentleman in the back, and then we're going to come to the speaker. Sir.
James String from Legal Action Against War. I'd like to ask particularly Sir Franklin, who very clearly considered that the drive of the ICC would be towards deterrence. That's the first point I want to address. And the second one was that he said it wouldn't be like the Nuremberg trials. It would be much fairer in, I think he was implying, in incriminating even Western powerful nations. Could he comment on the likelihood of, for example, the British government being taken before the ICC for the crimes against Iraq that are being committed at the moment in the bombing of the no-fly zones, which hit about 40% of targets are civilian, and therefore it's against the Geneva Convention, and the likelihood of crimes against the Iraqis under the Geneva Convention and of course all the rules in the ICC as well. What does he think is the likelihood of that? And one just rejoinder, do you think that the United Kingdom government would claim that they were carrying out a humanitarian mission in bombing Iraq as they do over the no-fly zones at the moment? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take a gentleman with glasses at the back, and then I'm going to take the speakers, and then I'm going to look over here for somebody. And over here. Yes, sir, at the back.
Thank you. I'm Fabrizio Variglia. I'm appeals counsel at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I was a member of the Argentine delegation throughout the ICC negotiations. I was not, as Chris so kindly said, a key drafter, but I did scribble a couple of articles. And I'm now enjoying teaching in LSE, a wonderful group of students. I would like to make briefly a couple of comments. First, there is some misperception in the title. And maybe we should say universal justice, or is the North prepared for it? During the conference, I think that most delegations coming from the South had no identity complex. We all knew that this was about what we were in some cases, in some of the cases what was still happening, and in some cases of other countries what unfortunately could happen in the future. And I think that the push coming from the South was precisely because of this. Now, I have my serious question as to whether the North has viewed itself as a potential customer of the ICC. The South definitely has. The North, I have my serious doubts. And when I'm speaking about customer, I'm not only speaking about potential accused, but of a particular involvement within the process. If you look at the ICTY record, it's quite problematic, starting with the French reluctance to admit that their general should go to testify before the ICTY, moving to the less than forthcoming response coming from NATO when the Office of the Prosecutor dared opening a preliminary inquiry as to whether there were war crimes committed in Kosovo. And this reluctance from a number of countries from the North, and a number of them friends of the court, is reflected in a number of key provisions of the ICC statute. For instance, unsurprisingly, the court doesn't have coercive powers. The court cannot summon witnesses. And this was, unfortunately, again, because of a number of pressures coming from countries from the North, notably the US, but a number of silent partners within the process. Another unfortunate example of this is the incredibly restrictive regime pertaining to national security information, which, despite all efforts made by Sir Frank Berman to have a reasonable provision, ended up being a highly restrictive provision, given the states the final word as to whether it should share information with the court or not. And it is a problem because, as Dr. Glacier said, the legitimacy of the court, although it's not entirely dependent on how it would deal with the case involving somehow someone or some agency coming from the north, it is clear that double standards will undermine the legitimacy of the court. And how ready is the north not to push the court into the horrible conundrum of having to embrace double standards or end up being paralyzed within the network of realpolitik? That is my question to the whole panel, probably.
Thank you very much. I think we'll start with Marlies, actually, when the first question was directed, and then go to Splankton, and then Christopher, if we may.
Okay, to begin with, I just had a little comment on this matter of the International Criminal Court being a symbol. For me, that doesn't mean it's a mere symbol and therefore not a working institution. I would think, for instance, of the Supreme Court as a very powerful symbol for United States citizens of what the law can do in the final instance. I don't think here in the UK it has quite the same status, but I think in the US that's very much the case. That's what I had in mind when I used the word symbol. And I also used the word symbol because I think there has to be a realization that not all cases of war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide will end up in the court. Then the matter of, could the bombing of Iraq be prosecuted? Now, I so much expected this question in one form or another that I already prepared a response. To begin with, I would want to emphasize that Saddam Hussein himself, of course, also has committed and probably continues to commit crimes against humanity, possibly genocide, and they cannot be prosecuted as long as Iraq hasn't ratified the treaty, which he probably well won't, obviously. So that should, when we're talking about impunity, that should also be kept in mind. Possible United States crimes, for obvious reasons, could not be prosecuted, as neither the US, the country of nationality, nor Iraq, the country of territory, are signatories to the treaty. Then, when it comes to the United Kingdom and Italy and Spain and possible others, I think the question is rather premature. There is no war yet. If the United Kingdom, Italy, and Spain go into this war, and if they then commit acts where at least there is a strong case that they might be war crimes, and if additionally they are unwilling to prosecute themselves, then the ICC might be the right forum, and I think they should have the courage to seriously consider that. That also goes into the next question a little bit, whether the North has considered that it might be a potential customer. I think you're absolutely right to point out that the South has had this moral courage to see itself as a potential customer. Three ratifying states that I just wanted to point out to you are Sierra Leone, Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, and Afghanistan. Three states that have just come out of conflict, maybe perhaps not even quite come out of conflict, who have decided that the International Criminal Court can be an insurance against their own future, the future of a possible government they might have. They may even be involved in it. So I think that's very important, and I don't think the North has been seeing it in quite the way. Have they viewed themselves as a potential customer? I think you kind of answered your own question. Yes, they have considered that, and that is the root of some of the more restrictive measures. I think France certainly has considered itself that way, but it has not quite made this moral commitment, I think, that many southern states have, to kind of put these aspects of their future into the hands of the court. And as I ended my talk, I think the biggest challenge for a future prosecutor is when such cases come up, what he will do with them. Because on the one hand, if he doesn't do them, I think it's very, very damaging to the legitimacy of the court. If he does do them, it might have very strong consequences, for instance, for funding or for the handing over of suspects to the court. So either way, it's going to be very difficult for the prosecutor, and I think that's the challenge. And that's, I think, the main reason I chose this title.
Yes, I do want to correct Marlies on just one point. It's not the whole truth to say that Iraqi abuses could not be brought before the court, because Iraq has not ratified the statute and is certainly not going to do so, for the reason that Christopher Hall gave a little earlier. The Security Council does have a power of referral, and it's going to be an extremely intriguing question to see whether the Council might not want to make use of that power at some time in the near future in some particularly striking, strong case which would provide a testing ground for the court and for its regime. I referred to deterrence, and I go back to that for just a moment, because every system, every criminal system, has to serve three purposes: the deterrent, preventive purpose, the repression, punishment, and rehabilitation. And if we were to create an international system which only focused on repression after the event, with no thought towards deterrence or prevention, and no thought towards rehabilitation, I think it would be a grossly flawed system. Now, the deterrence element was there in the justification that many governments gave in their parliaments and elsewhere as to why they were backing this project and backing it very solidly. And it has to be part of the process. And what's more, I think one has to cry out deterrence. So that it becomes something real. But we will have to cope with the rehabilitative function too. You can treat that as code for the interesting discussion which goes on about the tension between the implacable grinding of justice and truth and reconciliation within fractured communities. There is going to be no complete answer to that. But the two elements of the tension are both of them extremely important. Who can say what the prospects are of indictments being preferred by the prosecutor against states using force in Iraq, hypothetically, in the near future? We don't know. One is just right. But there is one thing I would like to say about the prosecutor, this emblematic figure, the independent prosecutor. This is an independent prosecutor. The prosecutor has to be independent of states, but the prosecutor also has to be independent in the prosecutorial judgment of all the rest of us too. It's a devilish job to find a prosecutor who will match up to this task with a staff matching up. It's one of the biggest challenges facing the court. But the independence means that if the prosecutor takes a decision, including those difficult decisions that particular allegations don't meet the threshold of gravity required, then that has got to be respected. If we all stand there with the rotten tomato ready to throw at the prosecutor as soon as a decision is taken, that is going to undermine the essential standing of this office. I think a difficulty we have, though, is not the independence of the prosecutor, it's the accountability of an international prosecutor. It's a problem one has edged around, maneuvered around the edges of without ever confronting it. And I think it is a real problem. There is no national prosecutor who is not in one way or another accountable. How you make an international prosecutor accountable, I'm afraid, remains beyond me, except to say that there is some interesting stuff in the statute, providing for a form of, not a judicial control, but judicial endorsement or non-endorsement of prosecutive actions, which edges us towards a very interesting system of international accountability. But we must respect the And I go finally to Fabricio's question, has the North faced up to the possibility of prosecution? The answer has to be yes. I mean, could a Dutch government, in the aftermath of the Srebrenica inquiry, which cost the country a government, not have faced up to the possibility that there might be prosecution? Or the Canadian government, after what happened in Somalia, or the Italian government, after what happened in Somalia? And I seem to recollect that Christopher is always the man who details, but at least one of our first European allies, probably more than one, has actually amended the Constitution to make it possible for the highest officers of state to be the subject of prosecutions before the ICC as a necessary move in producing internal legislation to enable ratification. Certainly France, maybe others beyond France. And if you're looking at me directly and saying, what did I say to my own political pastors, you'd be perfectly certain that they were well aware of it. Source for the goose is source for the gander. But that is something that is very wonderful across the world, human rights, and not just in this particular thing.
Well, I certainly can't do justice to all of the different points that have been raised either by my fellow panelists or in the audience, and we are. So I will just address a few particular points. One, with regard to the suggestion that there was a perhaps a democracy deficit with regard to the Solomon Islands. You know, it's traditional for states to have international experts on their delegations from other nationalities. And indeed, one of the great things about the entire process of drafting the statute, as well as the supplementary instruments, was it was a truly international community of government and NGO representatives involved in the process, who really, to a large extent, although sadly not entirely successfully, put aside national and regional thinking to draft an instrument that would last, if not for all time, perhaps at least a century. So I think that you know, that many people would be in many countries around the world would be somewhat surprised at what positions diplomats take. But I certainly do not think that was a problem. Every delegate had to operate under instructions, and I would hope that one doesn't go away from this panel thinking that Andrew Cotham behaved improperly. Second, I think on the question, another question related to accountability, which Sir Franklin raised. I think it's important to look at a number of provisions in the statute. One on Article 42, which sets out the scope of the office of the prosecutor and what the requirements are for the prosecutor, which are stringent and indeed are part of the reason we are still searching for a prosecutor. Prosecutor is definitely accountable in a number of ways, and can be removed from office under Article 46, can be disciplined under Article 47. The prosecutor simply cannot run around the world opening investigations or indicting people. In each case, his decisions to open an investigation are subject to challenge by states, by the suspects, and by the court on its own motion. And indeed, one of the big challenges for the court will be to make all of those provisions work in a way that will allow the court to begin trials at a reasonable time after the crimes occur. Moreover, the court can review a decision by the prosecutor not to open an investigation, though we fought very hard to ensure that the court could not order the prosecutor to open an investigation, because that would interfere with the prosecutor's independence, and we were pleased that the statute did not include that provision. In terms of planning, you know, I think Fabrizio Gaviria is correct. There are many governments in the North really haven't taken this fully into account. Although I think Sir Franklin indicated the United Kingdom definitely has, and the planning for any possible actions in Iraq have certainly taken these issues into account. I think the biggest challenge that the prosecutor will face will be developing neutral criteria in which he or she can decide where do I open in a preliminary inquiry in order to seek to decide whether to seek permission to open an investigation. And there will be a question of geographic balance in the public's mind. But I think if you look at the scale of crimes that we're talking about just in the past half century, with 1 to 3 million people killed in Cambodia, possibly a million in Rwanda, half a million in Indonesia under Sukarno, a quarter million in we're not even talking about cases you probably think of immediately, such as Argentina or Chile during the 1970s and 80s. Those are insignificant in comparison. one of the challenges in developing that criteria will be the statute itself, because the statute was carefully drafted and reflects some of the concerns of many states. And just to give you the example of war crimes, which will probably be one of the ones where the North, or individuals rather, in the North would be most exposed, is there's a threshold, which admittedly is advisory in Article 8, which deals with war crimes. But it it will, I think, be an important factor in the prosecutor's development of criteria. And that is, the court shall, it says, the court shall have jurisdiction in respect of war crimes, in particular, when committed as part of a plan or policy or as part of a large-scale commission of such crimes. Now, of course, the in particular language is very important. We fought very hard to ensure that that language was included, so this would, but it still will be guidance to the prosecutor, and that will be one factor. Another is Article 8 2B4, which reflects, to some extent, intensive pressure by the United States in the wording of it. And it says, it is a war crime intentionally to launch an attack in the knowledge that such an attack will cause incidental loss of life or injury to civilians or damage to civilian objects, or widespread or long-term and severe damage to the natural environment, which would be clearly excessive in relation to the concrete and direct overall military advantage anticipated. And of course, the key word is overall. And that is quite different from the language in the first protocol to the Geneva Conventions. So I think there will be many, many challenges. I don't envy the prosecutor. But it will, in the public's perception, even with the numbers that I've given you, if they do not investigate in a massacre of several hundred people that is attributable to armed forces from a northern country, and that country fails to properly investigate that incident, it will be difficult for the prosecutor as a political matter not to seek to investigate. What the answer is, I don't know.
Thank you, Christopher. I'm still looking for this side. I have a lady on my right. There's a gentleman at the back, I think. Sir, and then I've got the lady in the front here. And then I'll come back to you. Yes, we'll try and pack a number in before we finish. So can you be very, very concise, please?
Thank you very much. My name is Enver Hoxha, and I'm based at the Center for Study of Global Governments. Yesterday, international peacekeeping forces in Pristina arrested three people, and today three of them have been delivered to the ICTY. For 2 hours, I got the indictment from the ICTY Pristina office. And according to this indictment, these four people have been accused for war crimes committed to eight Albanian and Serbs citizens. And we know that during the conflict in former Yugoslavia, approximately have been killed 250,000 people. And we know that ICTY has limits in his work. The first comments from Pristina were that, the first leaders' political comments were that they support the work of ICTY and that they believe on ICTY justice. But there were another comments that ICTY, through this case, is trying just to create a balance between nations which were part of former Yugoslavia conflict. And my question is, do you believe that such cases, as we know that ICTY should deal with specific cases, really try to create a balance between the former nations? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. The lady in the front here.
Ms. Kirsten Sellers, I've just published a book called The Rise and Rise of Human Rights that looks at the war crimes trials. And I have a question for Franklin Berman and his comments about laying the ghosts of Nuremberg and Tokyo. And one of the things that you didn't address when you ran through these was the role of defense counsel in the International Criminal Court. Now, with Nuremberg, one of the other criticisms that was made was that the defense counsel were often treated as if they were enemy aliens, which in many cases they were. They were German, and some were former Nazis. And one of the reasons that there was not allied defense counsels at the court was, in Britain's case, Hartley Shawcross, the Attorney General, said that it would not be in the public interest for British defense counsels to defend Nazis at Nuremberg. Now, I'm not saying that this is a similar situation with the ICC, but it is notable that if you look down the Rome Statute, there is a very precise definition of the role and the responsibilities of the prosecution and the judges, but very little is said in this context about the role of the defense counsel. There is no office for the defense counsel, for example, and I would like to know what comments he had on that.
Thank you very much. I don't know how much our panel can sustain, but I'm determined to get a number of questions in, because maybe the last chance. Sir, yes, please. And then we'll take this gentleman who's been trying to get in just a few
seconds. Good evening. My name is Henry Ballesteros. I am a member and co-founder of Acción Colombia. It's a civil group in Colombia. You know that the terrorist group in Colombia kill and torture thousands of people every year. The terrorist group, the guerrillas, and the paramilitaries. Basically, if the Colombian government can finally do like or finish or get success in a peace process with this terrorist group, and you know that the peace process usually include a forgiveness for their crimes, and Colombia is a member of the International Criminal Court. For example, if this court accused these terrorist groups for doing war crimes, the Colombian government is forced to take these people into a court. That is my question.
Thank you. We're going to take a gentleman who's now standing up, and I'm looking over this side for possibly, I'm looking for gender balance here. There's a lot of men who want to assert themselves. I'll have to think about this. Women are going to get prepared, madam, yes, at you, and then we're going to have to go to the panel to sum up. Sir.
Thanks. David Chandler from the Centre for the Study of Democracy at Westminster. But I mean, it seems to be a very consensual discussion at the moment, but I just want to pose the possibility that just maybe the International Criminal Court might have something to do with bullying the South. And the sort of why I sort of made that statement is that I think there's a major assumption that it's justice and not bullying, and that assumption really relies on power, legality and morality all being stacked on the same side. And that two of the three speakers at least have said that the majority of the criminality in the world takes place in the South, and I think that sort of already sort of begins to load whether the ICC is giving justice or bullying, because, you know, assuming all the crime is in the South or most of it, then yeah, you know, there's possibilities stuff can be done. But if we sort of assume that a lot of criminality also took place in the North, people have mentioned Iraq or Afghanistan, etc., then I think it should be clearer that maybe the ICC wouldn't really be able to do that much. And even if you had independent judges and they made a ruling, what happens next? I mean, we've had courts before, the International Court of Justice, there's UN Security Council resolutions, and I think the thing that really makes the difference is a sort of set of relationships of power. It makes international society a bit different to domestic society. There isn't an independent police force and army and all the rest of it that's independent of a certain hierarchy and inequality. And I just think that it's a shame to have a discussion and then not talk about the really important points. But I better finish now. Thanks.
Thank you. We've begun to talk about what, from your perspective, the important points of view. So thank you very much for that. Our final, I regret to say, because I do like to stick by the promise that we end on time. Speaker from the floor, before we go to the panel, is you, madam.
Hello, my name is Nicole Connect.
Can you report it slightly back?
I have a question for Dr. Glassius. When you spoke of the gender aspect, does the International Criminal Court have any plans for targeting the problem of human trafficking and sex trade?
Thank very much. And what I'm now going to do is ask the speakers in the same order in which they made the presentations, briefly, both to respond if they judge it appropriate, no compulsion, and also to sum up thoughts, as it were, provoked by the discussion. Christopher, I think with you first.
It's true that the statute doesn't establish a defense office. However, the question of the defense is addressed both in the supplementary instruments and the rules of procedure, in the agreement on privileges and immunities and the headquarters agreement, very progressive provisions. There is an international criminal bar being formed, and the rights of the defense are also, to some extent, bolstered by the role of the pretrial chamber. With regard to amnesties are contrary to international law, and it would be, I think, impossible for a state party oppose a national amnesty against a request by the court to surrender a person who's accused. With regard to the question of the court not having an independent police force, that definitely is a problem. With regard to crimes in the north, I think it's important to look very closely at what the jurisdiction is of the realm statute. And if you are talking about absolute numbers of extrajudicial executions, absolute numbers of disappearances, absolute numbers of cases of torture, of cases of war crimes, and cases of crimes against humanity, in each category, I'm afraid, countries in the South are at present, although not necessarily always in the past, in the forefront. And that is exactly why this court is so strongly supported throughout the South by grassroots people who fought very hard for the court. Finally, obviously, human trafficking is a crime against humanity, which is within the jurisdiction of the court if you read Article 7.
The matter of balance brought up by you, will this International Criminal Court also feel that whenever they prosecute someone from one party in a conflict, they also need to prosecute someone from the other party? I mean, that is something for the future we don't know, but I think it is once again one of these big challenges for the prosecutor. And I think as we pile up the challenges for the prosecutor, you can see what a super person this is expected to be and why we don't have one yet. The same with the matter of the peace process. I mean, Christopher Hall is absolutely correct that in principle you can break through amnesty laws that try to give people impunity for gross violations of human rights, for crimes against humanity, for genocide. But there may be situations in which a prosecutor deems that he should not break into this particular peace process. Again, it is a matter of judgment. But yes, he definitely can prosecute. He doesn't have to. David Chandler seemed to consider the big issue of power, legality, and morality. I think exactly the strength of this court is that for the first time here is an institution that takes the power to punish others for the commitment of crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, away from the sole domain of states. So far it has only been possible in international law for states to be able to punish. They are arbitrary, they're vindictive, they're blunt. It is not a legal way of doing it, and I think that's the great strength of this International Criminal Court. And I agree with Chris Hall that most of the crime is in the South, though perhaps not all the criminals are in the South. If you look at structural causes, you may well come to the North, but if you actually look at the crimes, it is in the South. And finally, human trafficking. I think by saying, does the court have plans, you have to realize there is no prosecutor, there are no plans, but it is in the remit. It would be possible. And it would be very interesting, instead of taking someone from the kind of conflict area that we're all thinking of, to catch a big international human trafficker and indict him before the court.
Yes, thank you very much. I, like the other panelists, I'm also preoccupied as I hear comments made from around the floor from people who have bitter national experiences, what an enormous, enormous wave there is of expectations that the institutions of the group are going to have to meet. We simply cannot say at this stage how they're going to meet them, nor can we say as one smallish group, although happily quite a nice sized smallish group sitting in one particular capital in one particular part of the Western world, what the reception is going to be of the activity of this court across the globe. That is something that remains to be seen. I'm very glad, however, that there was a reference to the rights of the defence, because it is terribly easy for us all to be sucked into an attitude of mind which we say is a gross abuse of power. They reach a stage in which they come before a tribunal of this court. So really the people who are indicted, the people in the dock, are presumptively guilty. And we're going through a decent process to establish that that is actually there. That is not the way in which any decent self-respecting criminal tribunal can operate. The presumption of innocence, which is the fundamental part of our approach to criminal, is the bedrock of this statute. That's the way we're going to operate. There are good provisions about the right to counsel, access by counsel, and the rest of them in the statute, though again have to be turned into reality. The reality would have to be a long way away from here, and I agree with that. But even in the case of the ICTY in The Hague, there have been considerable murmurings, not more than murmurings, on the part of barristers from this country who have been involved in presenting defences in The Hague. They find that there is not a true equality of arms because there is a sort of institutional closeness between prosecutors and judges. These are just challenges that are part of the enormously ambitious enterprise of creating a court of this kind. As for power relationship, I simply didn't understand that question. Sorry, I don't. One knows about the terminology and the phraseology and the jargon. Within a court of this kind, there will be no power relationships to play. It's simply not constructed in a way that either permits or encourages it. So I think if we're talking about anything at all, we're talking about what happens in the broader political constituency within which the court is situated. Now, we know from experience that the reason why the Yugoslav tribunal in The Hague has managed in the end to get in the defendants' hands is because of an enormous political commitment and the actual physical process of arrest of indicted persons by Western states who've been involved militarily in the Yugoslavia. We don't yet know whether that's the kind of situation we replicate. It must be true, and I do entirely agree, that states which have ratified this undertaken the obligation to cooperate with the process, have taken on themselves a huge political commitment, and then better make it good, because if they don't make it good, then they will themselves be guilty of destroying the institution which they claim to support.
I know many of you wanted to speak. I'm sorry that it wasn't possible to fit your comments in. I hope they were dealt with by other speakers. I've always been impressed by the LSE's capacity to lay on these events, but I think we shouldn't forget that the events depend on speakers, people sometimes like Marlies who work here, others who come from sort of far afield as part of a public service obligation to engage with us this evening. I hope that in a moment you'll express your appreciation. Before you do, I want to tell you that the last round table in the series is on the 6th of March, Corporate Social Responsibility, with Noreena Hertz, Meghna Desai, and Adele Simmons speaking. Those of you who are close to the door have the advantage of being first to buy the book. There may be a limited supply, I'm not sure. But please, before you rush to buy the book, could you thank our three excellent speakers?